Good evening, and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. On the show tonight...
The indictment accuses Madigan of leading, for nearly a decade, a criminal enterprise.
Northern Illinois' top federal prosecutor on Madigan, Burke, violence, and much more.
Renewed calls to remove the Trump signage on the Trump Tower downtown.
What better way than to shine a light on a dark place?
Here, how one North Lawndale resident is spreading holiday cheer.
Chicago has been her beat for nearly 30 years, and she's been a regular here on Chicago Tonight. Journalist Madeline Hejerka joins us for more on her next chapter.
Iman has always attempted to be a place that responds to the needs of our community, period.
New art spaces opened in the Chicago Lawn neighborhood.
And Brandis and Paris, as you mentioned, I'm in North Lawndale, where I will be reporting live tonight as part of our Chicago Tonight in Your Neighborhood series. And yes, we are serving up holiday cheer as this becomes a winter Lawndale land. Of course, good deeds continue throughout the year, so we've got the buzz on everything from beekeeping to boxing. But first, back to you in the studio.
Thanks, Amanda. And now to some of today's top stories.
She's safe. She's on a plane. She's on her way home. After months of being unjustly detained in Russia, held under intolerable circumstances, Brittany will soon be back in the arms of her loved ones, and she should have been there all along.
WNBA star Brittany Griner is free 10 months after her arrest in Russia on drug charges. In exchange, the U.S. released notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Bout, once nicknamed the Merchant of Death. Griner's wife, Sherelle, was with President Joe Biden when he announced Griner's release.
Today, I'm just standing here overwhelmed with emotions, but the most important emotion that I have right now is just sincere gratitude for President Biden and his entire administration.
The U.S. failed to free another American in the high-profile prisoner exchange. Paul Whelan is a corporate executive from Michigan who was arrested in Moscow in 2018 and remains jailed in Russia. Whelan's family welcomed the news of Griner's release. President Biden says his administration is continuing to work to free Whelan.
Bail is denied for Oak Park native Heather Mack. She'll remain behind bars as she awaits trial next year in relation to the 2014 death of her mother in Bali. Mack served more than 7 years in an Indonesian prison after being found guilty of helping her boyfriend, Tommy Schaefer, kill her mother when the three were in Bali. Sheila Von Wiesmack's body was found stuffed in a suitcase in a taxi outside a Bali hotel. Mack was released from prison in Indonesia and deported to the U.S., where she was immediately arrested on federal charges of conspiracy and obstruction of justice. Mack's attorney argued she was not a flight risk or a danger to the community. U.S. District Judge Matthew Kennelly disagreed, saying there was, quote, plenty of reason to believe that when Miss Mack has conflicts with other people, she resolves them with violence.
Walgreens is announcing a partnership with DoorDash and Uber to deliver an oral COVID-19 drug to your door for free. Paxlovid, which is manufactured by Pfizer, is an antiviral therapy that helps prevent people who've been infected with the virus from being hospitalized or dying. Walgreens says the new program is aimed at increasing access to COVID-19 treatments, especially for those in medically underserved areas.
And coming up in the program, we're live in Chicago's North Lawndale community with one resident's mission to light up the West Side.
But first, U.S. Attorney John Lausch joins us to talk recent cases and convictions and what's next right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Tackling bribery scandals, public corruption, and Chicago crime is no easy feat. But it is the job of Northern Illinois' top federal prosecutor, who recently announced a major racketeering case that took down members of a reputed Chicago gang.
Also this year, multiple indictments, former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan on racketeering and bribery charges involving ComEd and now AT&T. And here to discuss all these big cases and more is U.S. Attorney John Lausch. U.S. Attorney Lausch, welcome back to Chicago Tonight.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with those recent AT&T charges. The company, its president, former Speaker Madigan, and his associate, Mike Mike McClain, all charged in this alleged scheme where the company made payments to a Madigan ally. Can you lay out these charges for the public?
Yeah, so I can't go beyond what's in the charges or what's in the deferred prosecution agreement for AT&T Illinois. But, it lays out, kind of a similar, scheme that we saw in connection with the other, cases involving Mike McClain and Mike Madigan, essentially payments to an individual who's an ally of the former speaker. And, and in return for that, and that's being done in order to influence and reward Madigan in connection with legislation.
And it's a deferred prosecution agreement with AT&T. Do you anticipate more charges coming?
So in connection with, overall, we're always open for business. And so, our investigations are always ongoing. But as far as the deferred prosecution agreement, that lays out where we stand with that entity, with AT&T Illinois. And if they uphold their end of the bargain for the next 2 years, then we would dismiss
that
charge.
So that kind of closes the book.
That closes the book on the entity there. And then we obviously have the indictment of the president of the company, and that will proceed.
Those two entities, but of course, ComEd, AT&T, they've been charged so far in this scheme. Is it, what is the likelihood that, we could anticipate that this pattern of behavior has gone beyond just these two corporations?
Yeah, so again, I can't get into that a whole lot, but what I guess I will say, and this is in every case, whether it was this one or anything else, we charge cases, we proceed towards trial, and sometimes we learn new information. Sometimes other people come forward. Sometimes we learn things during the course of our, of getting ready for trial, and we realize there's additional charges that are appropriate. I'm not saying that's going to happen here at all. I couldn't say that, and here I don't know whether we'll see anything. But, we always keep our eyes and ears open, and we proceed as we see fit.
Another major prosecution under your watch is former Alderman, Alderman Ed Burkle, soon be former Alderman, indicted more than 4 years ago on corruption charges. Still a trial not set to begin until November of next year. Are you frustrated at the slow pace of this process?
So, I think it is... I think we all like to see things happen swiftly, but we're also very realistic about things. We did have the pandemic that came into play here as well, which, kind of put a lot of our trials on hold, for various points of time. And, and we had trials throughout the whole pandemic, but at least the schedule, was much slower. That, we needed to really, we had social distance trials, and so things, kind of got on a slower track. I'm a believer in justice delayed is justice denied. It can be in some ways, but we need to make sure it gets done right. Right. And that's one of the reasons why when we see delays sometimes for things getting to trial, it's because, the defense, they need to, there's certain things with the evidence, certain things with the discovery that they need to get done. And the judge needs to manage, his or her docket in order to ensure that we're proceeding, expeditious in a way that's fair.
Give us a sense, if you would, of, why cases like this can take so long to investigate in the first place. Do you, the measures that you have to go through, but are you ever, sort of frustrated that after you've done all of that, it can take so long to get to trial?
Yeah, I think anybody who, who's a prosecutor, sometimes, especially when trial dates get moved, sometimes that happens, but look, sometimes it's because of us. Sometimes trials, it gets moved because we add additional charges.
Or there's voluminous evidence.
Right, and there's voluminous evidence. Right. And so, I don't know that I would use the word frustrated. It's just part of what we've become used to. That said, I understand where the public sometimes will say, boy, this has been a long time. When is this going to happen? I get that. And that's why you will see our prosecutors regularly saying, we're ready for trial, Judge, and then we, it'll either happen or, then, or it'll happen at some point down the road.
We should mention this coming year, 2023, you have some major trials happening, especially related to ComEd and Mike Madigan and his associates, basically.
Right, we do. We have that, the first trial. We have the trial of McClain and some of the other, folks in that kind of initial group of four people charged related to ComEd in March. We have the Burke trial in November. We have some other trials sprinkled throughout the year. The Tim Mapes trial is in the summer, I believe.
I want to ask you, you have all these big cases, but there's an obscure case involving the Cook County Land Bank. And for our viewers, that's a quasi-governmental organization. It buys up distressed properties. It flips them and sells them. You recently announced charges against a former official at this land bank. Yep. Can you tell us what your office is looking into with respect to this organization?
Yeah, I mean, I can't go, beyond the four corners of what's there, but it's like any other case, right? When it comes in, I mean, we want to investigate it fully, and we want to bring charges when it's appropriate. But I really can't go much further than to what we've already put out in our recent charge connected to that.
So I want to shift to something. A University of Chicago released this first national investigation of federal pretrial detentions, finding a, quote, federal jailing crisis, particularly with federal judges routinely violating bail laws. Report says that pretrial detention rates for people charged with federal crimes has increased, gone up from 29% to 75% since 1984. What is your reaction to something like that?
Yeah, so I haven't read that report yet. Kind of shortly before I came on here, I had learned that there was a report, and I do plan to read it. So, look, I will. One of the things I think we do well in the federal system, and I think we do well in Chicago, is the handling of pretrial detention. Here's why I say that: is it's a very thoughtful process. In my office, in particular, you have a prosecutor, you have a defense lawyer, and the judge, and then a pretrial services officer who are evaluating: is this person a risk of flight or a danger to the community? Right. And if they are, we will seek pretrial detention. And if we meet certain standards, when it's a stiff standard, we need to show by clear and convincing evidence, for instance, if someone's a danger to the community, then the judge can detain that person pretrial. And, you know, one reason why I think maybe that's gone up is because we've seen in federal cases, we've seen people, you know, charged with more serious crimes, for instance, violent crimes. You know, we have a bunch of RICO cases that we've done, a lot of our firearm cases that we will bring. You know, we're bringing those because we believe that this can have a, you know, this have more of an impact. The person, based upon the nature of their criminal history or their conduct, we believe that they are a danger to the community, and so that's why we'll ask for detention there.
Yeah. Chicago's also down in the number of homicide cases this year, just under 650 compared to 765 this time last year. Do you feel like your office is making, you know, sufficient progress in holding people accountable?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, I don't know that anybody can say we're making sufficient progress. 650 homicides is far too many. One thing I will say, I mean, the fact that we will, you know, we're on a trend that will end 100 homicides less than last year, like, that's a good thing. We should all, like, say it's a good thing, and it does show... You know, before we can get down to the numbers where, you know, down to the 400s where we were only in 2014, which was not that long ago, we need to make these steps along the way. So it is progress. I don't know that I would say it is sufficient progress because no one's happy with the number that we have. And it takes all of us. It takes our office doing what we can to hold people accountable. That's really important.
Well, you mentioned that RICO case, a racketeering case that took down reputed members of a Chicago gang. What is this? Translate this to the folks that live in these neighborhoods. Yeah. What does this mean for them that some of these folks in this gang are being taken to task for racketeering?
Right. And so this case in particular, it's a remarkable case in the sense, I mean, it started, you know, like a lot of our cases do, as, you know, kind of a run-of-the-mill kind of, you know, investigation into a group of individuals selling drugs in a particular neighborhood in the city of Chicago. And it was law enforcement, it was ATF and Chicago Police Department, first and foremost, like just following the evidence where it led. And where it ultimately led was, you know, a RICO case, 13 people charged, 19 murders, 19 attempted murders, armed robberies, drug trafficking involved in it. And so what does it ultimately mean for the people in the community is that the people who were responsible for multiple shootings, multiple murders, are now no longer in that community anymore to continue to wreak havoc on people. And, you know, I think what happens in Chicago and other parts of the country, too, is people in the neighborhoods, they know. They know who's committing the crimes. They know who are killing people. And I think a lot of times they're afraid. They're afraid to talk. And so when we're able to bring a case like this, it can provide some relief in the sense of, okay, someone is looking out for us. There are people we can talk to ultimately bring justice for us in our neighborhoods so that we don't have to have people getting shot on a regular basis.
Of course, some would say there's also the instance of mistrust that some might have with yes. government agencies that are investigating. But before we let you go, because we're almost out of time, you kept your job, as we know, in 2021 after almost being asked to resign when President Biden took office. A number of senators asked that you remain. Yeah. How long would you like to stay in this job?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a great job. I love this job. You know, I serve at the pleasure of the president. And, you know, and I, as I tell people when they ask me that question, I get asked that a lot. Like, it's not a lifetime job. I realize that. And I'm fortunate every day that I'm here. You know, and we'll see what the future holds. But, you know, as long as I'm there, we're going to continue to do great work because we have great people working in our office.
Okay. All right. U.S. Attorney John Lausch.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And up next, we check in with Amanda Vinicky, who's reporting live tonight from Chicago's North Lawndale community. Stay with us. Some 35,000 Chicagoans call North Lawndale home. That's according to the latest census figures. 80% of those residents are black. The median annual income is about $31,000, roughly half the median income for Chicago overall. Poverty and violence are part of the West Side community area's story. But community leaders say there's much more to it. Our Amanda Vinicky and producer Blair Paddock spent time in North Lawndale this week as part of our Chicago Tonight In Your Neighborhood series. Amanda is on one of the main thoroughfares there, Ogden Avenue. Amanda, what's going on?
Oh, Brenda, Chicago has some fabulously festive traditions, and some of my personal favorites, dining under the big giant tree at the Walnut Room, the Chris Kendall Martin, having some glug at Simon's. But North Lawndale residents are creating some new traditions. This Saturday at about this time, Douglas Boulevard will be all lit up and bright for Light Up Lawndale.
Started because, unfortunately, they have pegged Lawndale with, like, this really bad rep. Unless you're having a big festival here, there's no reason to come here. They don't look at the actual people that are here and how they have to live here on the regular basis. So a couple of years ago, when I kept hearing about all the bad crime that kept going across the media, I'm like, no, there's a different side of Lawndale. And how do we display that, right? Okay, cool. Let's do something different. And that different to me was something very small to me, but it meant a lot to a lot of other people.
This is the third annual Light Up Lawndale, the brainchild of Princess Shaw, who says it is literally about shining light in a normally dark place. Also about changing the narrative of her neighborhood. She admits that initially there were some practical challenges, like a lack of power outlets and also no ladders to string lights up high in the trees. But then she discovered battery-powered lights, which they and volunteers use to wrap around the tree trunks. There is a new challenge this time around. More lights are needed. And by the way, they are still accepting donations and sponsorships for that. And why the need for those more lights? It is because they are doubling the area that will be lit up from 15 to 30 blocks.
We're trying to encompass more of the actual neighborhood to get more people to get in the holiday spirit, unlike they've been in the years past, especially with the pandemic that happened and, you know, people were just kind of stuck in the house and they kind of were, you know, in a gloomy mood. So we're trying to cheer them up.
The lights are part of a full day of winter Lawndale land, with the afternoon kicking off with a Christmas party in Franklin Park. Children will be able to receive scarves and gloves, also lunch and books. That is through North Lawndale Reads, part of the Open Books program.
We want to make sure our primary goal is that every kid can get a book. Every kid has a book. Every kid has something to read. And then adults also have something to read so that they're modeling reading for their children. Books are sometimes like $20, $25, $17, $18, $19. That's very expensive for a lot of people. It's expensive for me, you know? So thinking about how to get more free books, free high quality good books in the hands of kids is the point of this event.
Literacy, of course, very important. And books are, in my opinion, a wonderful gift. But Chelsea Ridley says she knows that it is Christmas and kids want toys. Gifts will be available from babies through teenagers. And then after that party in Franklin Park, folks are invited to ride their bikes over to the other side of Lawndale, over to Douglas Park. And who's going to be there for Light Up Lawndale? Well, I know you're going to guess that the answer is Santa Claus. But actually, no, it is Santa's alter ego who is going to be paying a visit to the West Side this weekend.
Bandy Claus came as the savior to come back and give identification back into the African-American community. And it is not Santa Claus, it's Bandy Claus.
So what does Bandy Claus wear?
So Bandy Claus wear what his cousin Santa Claus wear.
Okay.
Only difference is he has it red, black, and green.
I regret that I have no photos of Bandy Claus to show you, but Brown promises that he will take some pictures this weekend. If he sends it to me, I'll post them to social media so you can have a look at Bandy Claus in his African-American-inspired outfit. Now, most of the year, though, Brown is busy not dressed up as Banty Claus, but rather leading a boxing program for area youth.
Boxing Out Negativity is not just a boxing program. It is a way of life. Just like in the ring, we teach our youth to make split-second decisions, and they have to make these same decisions when they go out throughout the community.
Brown says in his youth, he had a reputation for knocking people out. This was a well-earned reputation that he says got him into a lot of trouble with the law. Now, in order to try and prevent that for this generation, he is training around 45 youth daily for free by training them as boxers. And by the way, this is not mild training by any means. Some of the Boxing Out Negativity participants are literally national champs. And by the way, they've got a big competition coming up the weekend after next with the Silver Glove Championship. So wish them well. Brown also says that he does depend on the generosity of funders, and that has been a challenge lately. Another big presence in the community is the North Lawndale Employment Network. And this is an organization founded and run by Brenda Palms, and it does a lot, from helping families that are struggling to pay to keep their lights on, pay their energy bills, also job training. And then it also, this is an organization that runs the Be Love Cafe, and our little team spent some time working from there this afternoon. I had a latte that was sweetened with honey that was made by part of the Sweet Beginnings program. This is a beekeeping training for the formerly incarcerated. Palm says that she started this because she realized that those who were leaving prison hadn't had traditional employment in a long time. And then also when they went to look for work, often employers didn't really want them. So her solution was beekeeping, both teaching them skills, but also she says it changed the conversation with prospective employers.
And suddenly they're asking, well, what is it like to be a beekeeper? And then there's a different dialogue that starts to take place. And so I love when that happens, when it opens up an opportunity for the men and women that we serve to be truly seen for the asset and for the contributions that they can make to the business.
Palms says that, yes, back in the day, Sears was based here. Sears was the Amazon of its age right here in North Lawndale. And Palms says she knows that the entire society experience and employment situation has changed. But the North Lawndale Employment Network is helping to connect residents with opportunities that are available to them today. Things like solar panel training, as well as transportation, distribution, and logistics. These, she says, are well-paying jobs that can help to support a family.
We learned that 57% of the adults in North Lawndale have had some involvement in the criminal justice system. And when you understand that, you realize why the unemployment rate in North Lawndale is so high. It isn't because people don't want to work, right? It's because they're battling the stigma of having a criminal record.
Palms says that North Lawndale is a community on the rise, and that was a common theme with folks that we talked to, that they're trying to shed any sort of negative stigma around their community, and they are putting in the work to make it happen. And again, this Saturday, that work will be served up with a dose of holiday cheer. We've got more coming up, but sending it back to you in the studio, Brandis.
Amanda, I appreciate that Banty Claus is making himself available for photos, because it's really hard to get a picture of Santa. So thank you. We'll see you in a little bit. And now to Paris and Donald Trump in the news in Chicago. Paris.
Brenda, few things have stirred as much architectural controversy in recent years as the massive Trump sign on Donald Trump's Chicago Tower. The Chicago Tribune editorialized today that the sign should come down, saying, quote, reintroduce an ordinance, evoke moral turpitude, try to get it taken down, this time with our support, and we'll wager most everyone who lives there. The Trib's editorial board had originally argued that the sign should stay up, but says the former president's recent actions and his company's conviction for tax fraud charges changes the equation. And joining us are Alderman Gilbert Villegas of Chicago's 36th Ward and Jacob Hubert, president of the Chicago-based Liberty Justice Center. We also invited the Trump Organization to send a representative to join us, but they did not respond. Alderman Villegas, first with you, you introduced an ordinance last year to have this sign taken down. First, why do you believe it should come down?
Well, I introduced that ordinance on the heels of January 6th. You know, I was in the Marine Corps, and I took an oath to defend this country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And what we saw on January 6th was horrible, and it was led by Donald Trump. And so we wanted to put an ordinance in place because we wanted to make sure that anyone that was involved in January 6th could not do business with the city of Chicago. And so we introduced it, and we got it passed in March.
And I want to come back to you with some specifics on what you want to introduce now. But Jacob Huber, what do you think of this discussion and the calls for Trump to take that sign down and whether the city even has any authority to do that?
Well, look, the city is targeting this sign because they don't like what it says. And if the First Amendment means anything, it means the government can't target speech. It can't tell people to take down their signs because they don't like what they say. And so this is totally inappropriate. It doesn't matter what you think of Donald Trump. A person who owns a building has a right to put what they want on that building, certainly including the name of the building or the name of the owner. So it's an offense against First Amendment rights, but of course one that's all too familiar in the city of Chicago.
Alderman Villegas, what about that? It's hard to find a legal argument here that would say the First Amendment doesn't apply here, that a private property owner can do what they want.
Well, again, this is not targeted. This is around the January 6th insurrection, that the ordinance that we put forward. The irony is that the First Amendment speech and the president talking about eliminating the Constitution, it's really awkward that our guest here is defending that. But that being said, right now we have our legal team taking a look at expanding for those that are that have signs that are convicted of crimes and expanding it to tax fraud to see how it works. We got right now we have attorneys that are investigating. I'm working closely with Alderman Riley since it's in his ward. I want to make sure that working collaboratively to figure a way to address the issue around.
So you're saying
people doing business with the city.
Someone convicted of tax fraud then, like this,
expanding
wouldn't be able to,
categories, yes.
Jacob Huber, something like that, does that sound like it passes legal muster?
No, because if you commit a crime, whether it's tax fraud, whether it's insurrection or treason or whatever, well, those crimes, if you're convicted of them, have a specific sentence. And the sentence isn't you lose all of your rights everywhere. You, like in the case of the Trump tax cases, well, the Trump organization and whatever the companies are will have to pay fines. They don't just lose all of their rights, not only in New York and Chicago and anywhere else anybody wants to punish them. You can't just take people's rights away because you don't like something they did somewhere else that they're being punished for by somebody else. It doesn't work that way.
So, Alderman Villegas, say you do pass an ordinance like this, aren't you opening the city up to a host of lawsuits from someone that is known to be very litigious? And right. Do you really want to expose the city to that?
And I think that's why we're taking a look at this. We have attorneys that are reviewing it to see if there's a pathway. So right now we're looking at the Constitution, making sure that we're doing things correctly. And right now there's attorneys that are reviewing it. And you're right, we don't want to put ourselves in a position given the history of the former president and how litigious he is.
Jacob Huber, do you see any legal pathway here that the city can go down to force this, or should they go to the negotiating table then with the Trump organization and try to figure something out there?
Well, I'm not here out to tell the city how it should stop people from saying what they want to say. I think it should leave people alone and let them put up the signs that they want to put up. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they could try something and they could take it to court and see what happens. But they shouldn't be able to get away with it because it's pretty basic that you can't target a sign because you don't like what it says. And by the way, it doesn't matter also that Donald Trump said stupid things about the Constitution recently. Well, you don't waive your constitutional rights because you say something like that. You still have them, no matter who you are.
And we should note for our viewers that under current city rules, that Trump sign is too big. The thing is, that ordinance was passed after Trump put his sign up there, so Trump is kind of grandfathered in there. What about that, Alderman Villegas? What about having the city go and negotiate with the Trump organization and play hardball, like the Trib editorial suggested? Go to the table and say, take this thing down.
Well, that could be an option as well. Again, we have all the attorneys taking a look at what would be the best path forward to make sure that we're doing everything legal and not putting ourselves in a position where we'd be costing taxpayers any type of money.
Given the Trib made the argument that, given the organization's conviction on tax fraud and recent statements about the Constitution, it does change the equation. Now, Jacob Hubert, I want to go back to you on this. I mean, the Tribune is making this case, but how does it change the equation?
It doesn't. You know, I saw that what the Tribune said before when they defended the sign and said, what about the First Amendment? What about property rights? And now they're saying, well, Trump, you know, got in trouble for these things, and so we've changed our mind. But that's just not how the First Amendment works. If the government's going to strip you of their rights, you have to have due process. And whatever due process Trump is getting is coming through the actual cases that are brought against him. And those cases will impose specific consequences. It doesn't mean it's open season on Trump's rights everywhere. That's just not how this works.
Alderman Villegas, you mentioned the ordinance that was introduced a year ago. When do you expect a new ordinance to be introduced, and how might it be different? You, I mean, you say your attorneys are reviewing all of this, but what might be different, and when will you introduce that?
Well, again, we're working closely with Alderman Brendan Riley. It's in his ward, and we're looking at the Legislative Reference Bureau to make sure that we're dotting I's, crossing T's, and we have some other attorneys looking at things. So I don't want to expand on it yet because of the fact that they're still doing some research. But I can tell you that when we're talking about the president and our guest here is, you know, downplaying the comments about, you know, eliminating the Constitution, reinstating himself. I mean, those are troubling. You have someone that's notorious, that says some crazy things, but he has millions of people that follow him. It's dangerous, and so we got to make sure that. We're taking these things serious. We saw what happened on January 6th, and now people should be concerned when the former president's talking about eliminating the Constitution and reinstating himself.
All right, I have to leave the discussion there. I want to thank both of you, Alderman Gilbert Villegas, Jacob Hubert. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we're back with more Chicago Tonight right after this.
How do we find resources we had no idea about?
The community seems to want us to be in this space.
There's plenty of potential to do that stuff and keep it within the neighborhood and keep it ours.
There's much more ahead on the program, including the story of a store bringing fresh produce to North Lawndale. But first, the Inner City Muslim Action Network, or IMAN, is celebrating 25 years of commitment to community with a new art gallery and ceramic studio meant to serve the Chicago Lawn neighborhood and surrounding area. Arts correspondent Angel Ito takes us to the southwest side for a look at those new community spaces.
These students are getting a taste of Amon's newest addition, their ceramic studio.
It looks like me. I made myself. My dreads. As you can see, my hair is messy, my nose is fat, and my eyebrows are bushy.
They're a part of Amon's Green Reentry Program, which provides transitional housing, job training, education, and more for returning citizens and high-risk youth.
The series they just finished today by, I think, fourth and final session. It was a chance for them to get into the ceramic studio to get a taste of it. So right now they're completing orientation. So they'll be in orientation until the end of this year, 2022. Next year they'll get a chance to go back into the ceramic studio. There's a quote that we refer to often, that if you want to get somewhere you've never been, you have to be willing to try something you've never tried.
One of the newest members of the Green Reentry Program says the resources they provide have helped him greatly.
They got counselors for us here. We see once a week, so I enjoy that, being able to come talk about what I have going on the outside. I never thought I'd be doing ceramics. I love it because I could come express myself without thinking about all the outside noise. They made me more of a man than I was when I first came in here, because like they hold me accountable for all the stuff I think I'm gonna get away with.
We're really trying to shift and represent, you know, just kind of a righteous culture in general. So, you know, the standards that we uphold within the space, it's really something people are looking for, but sometimes I'm not able to verbalize. But to be able to interact and hold each other up, lift each other up, learn from each other, eat together, laugh together, be challenged together, it's a big part of who IMAN is. Brings a lot of value to IMAN as a whole, and I think to our communities, we just don't have enough spaces like this, so it's one that we hold very sacred.
Amon's commitment to creative spaces also extends to their new Amanifest Art Gallery, which houses a selection of 45 nationally recognized artists.
In communities where we've had generational trauma and we've had like decades of trauma, just having a safe space, period, is so needed and is to not be taken for granted. You know, you have like really unique interactions that take place, so the physical space of a ceramic studio where that's happening, all these spaces that are just very unique and offer so much hope and the ability to process through life together with others.
With an existing main campus that currently offers a full healthcare center, Amon's mission remains focused on health and wellness for both the mind and body.
What's really important for us is an emphasis on a holistic model, on a model that emphasizes that it's not just healthcare that is going to help save our communities. It's not just, you know, a focus on education. It's not just a focus on jobs for returning citizens. It's an understanding that you need a holistic model to actually address the decades of systemic and structural racism.
While a foundation of the group's principle is rooted in Muslim spiritual traditions, they say their commitment is to serve everyone.
Iman is not Iman without the coalitions that we're a part of, without the alliances that we're a part of. We're an organization that I think stands out to a lot of people because at the core of our work is this emphasis on bringing people together. Iman has always attempted to be a place that responds to the needs of our community, period.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Ito.
And you can visit our website for more information on how to get involved in Iman's newest health and wellness programs. Paris.
Prentice, thank you. And still to come on Chicago Tonight, a state lawmaker talks about changing up North Lawndale's narrative. We have a live report again from the West Side. A Chicago journalist bows out. We talk with Marlin Hejerica about her retirement and what's next. And a Little Village native is bringing something new to 26th Street by making a sweet treat the old-fashioned way. First, some more of today's top stories. A downstate lawmaker was taken to the hospital this morning with an undisclosed medical condition. Local reports there say first responders were called to Democrat Scott Bennett's home in Champaign shortly before 3 a.m. In a statement, Governor J.B. Pritzker says, quote, "Scott Bennett is genuine, kind, and dedicated to serving his constituents. MK and I are keeping Scott, Stacy, and his entire family and community in our prayers." Bennett is a former prosecutor and was responsible for introducing an amendment to clarify the language and community protection measures in the Safety Act, which ends cash bail starting in January. More help could be on the way to keep invasive Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. A provision of the National Defense Authorization Act passed by the U.S. House in a bipartisan vote today includes increased funding for the Brandon Road Lock and Dam Project. The lock and dam are designed to prevent the carp from traveling from the Mississippi River Basin into the Great Lakes. Molly Flanagan with the Alliance for the Great Lakes welcomed the move, saying in a statement, quote, "This commitment shows that House members recognize that the invasive carp moving toward Lake Michigan threatened the entire Great Lakes region. We urge the Senate to move swiftly to pass their version of the bill and for the president to sign it." Efforts to clear blocked bicycle lanes passed through a key city panel. The vote by the City Council's Transportation Committee took place 6 months after 3-year-old Lily Shambrook died while riding in a carrier on her mother's bicycle. The toddler was struck by a semi-truck after her mother was forced to go around a ComEd truck parked in the bike lane. The measure is set for a final vote Wednesday and would give employees of the Department of Finance, not just members of the Chicago Police Department, the authority to order vehicles blocking bike lanes to be ticketed and towed. And now, Brandis, we go back to you.
Paris, thank you. Now we return to North Lawndale, where Amanda Venicky spent the day as part of our In Your Neighborhood series. Amanda.
Brandis, earlier today, State Representative Lakeisha Collins took a busy part. She had a whole lot of meetings, but she spent some time talking with us. Collins recently won re-election to represent North Lawndale as well as other parts of the city's west and near north sides. I started out by asking Collins about what she accomplished in her first term in Springfield.
I think I really hit the ground running. I passed a number of measures to ensure that families across the district and the state of Illinois can really thrive. And so I'm really proud of a lot of legislation I did around childcare, because that's essential legislation I did around trying to reform DCFS, and then also you know, making sure that families could stay in their homes. That was very critical because of the pandemic. We knew that families, especially here on the west side of Chicago, were looking at evictions. So making sure that they can have a home to still live in and, you know, be able to take some of that burden off their backs was important.
And of course, childcare during the pandemic was really highlighted, yes, how both essential it is, the lack of childcare providers and accessibility to it. This, you passed also a measure that is personal to you. Can you share more about that?
So yes, House Bill 4242 is a measure that will expand childcare for youth in care. So I was a former youth in care. I got pregnant at the age of 20. And so currently you can emancipate at 18 from DCFS or 21. I stayed until 21. But when I got pregnant with my oldest son, childcare was really hard to find. And so I knew that those issues still existed today. And I wanted to make sure that if we're really going to have a pathway for our youth in care to emancipate and be stable, that they needed childcare. And so that's something I'm really proud of.
So this legislation guarantees that youth in care who have children can get what? Free childcare for them.
Be able to look for, you know, a job, further their education, and not have to worry about those burdens.
Now, in addition to being state representative, you were also just elected by your peers as the chair of the Illinois House Black Caucus. What are priorities for the Black Caucus going to be? There was a lot accomplished, particularly in the wake of George Floyd's murder, and the Black Caucus had a huge agenda that was passed. What's next?
Ooh. Continue to build off our four pillars, putting structures in place to make sure that our communities can really see, you know, what their legislators are doing. I think that, you know, we have legislators who are all across the state. We all bring unique ideas to the table. We all have a different set of skills. And so I really want to amplify that going into the 103rd General Assembly, but making sure that we continue to build on our pillars, because there's so much more work that needs to be done in the Black communities throughout the state of Illinois.
Do you have any particular legislation that you're planning to push, either in your role as state representative or Black House Caucus Chair?
So I am going to continue to reform DCFS, because there is a number of, it's heavily populated with Black and brown children, and there are problems there. The culture needs to change. But I do have hope that we'll get to where we need to be to make sure that our youth in care thrive. And the only way we can do that is making sure that people with lived experiences are sitting at the table.
And of course, tell me some about your district. Did you grow up in Lawndale? And what do people not know about this area that they should?
So my father, his side of the family is from K-Town, which is in North Lawndale. As a young girl, I was living from house to house. And so that's the thing of being a youth in care. But I didn't become a youth in care until I was a teenager. But as a young girl, I did live house to house. The thing that people are, you know, the narrative of North Lawndale is that it's a dangerous place to be. It's not. The people here in North Lawndale, they love each other. They help out one another. Even during a pandemic, I saw it for myself. You know, everyone just, they were all in. And so I really like to highlight the work that is going on in this community, from the organizations, you know, to the churches, to the families, because the narrative, it has to change.
Ann Collins says that her community is very vocal about its needs and, again, really puts in the work to make it happen. There is a lot going on here. She says you've got the farm on Ogden. You have a new grocery store that aims to secure much of its produce from Black farmers. And where I'm standing on Ogden Avenue, that used to, of course, be Route 66 carrying through the city of Chicago, I'm right by the Lawndale Christian Health Center, another not-for-profit that also has a cafe that we again worked from today, so thanks to the folks at the Green Tomato. That's all we have from the Lawndale community area tonight. Sending it back to you in the studio.
Always thankful for the cafes in the neighborhood when you're on In Your Neighborhood. Amanda, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
A longtime Chicago journalist just stepped away from her job after 30 years covering crime, politics, education, and urban affairs. Her regular Chicago Chronicle's columns in the Sun-Times focused on positive stories from the black and brown communities. Along the way, Maudlin Hejrica has written books and mentored young journalists, this one included. Maudlin Hejrica joins us now. Congratulations, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back. We've done some redecorating since the last time you were here.
See.
Why now? Why was this the time you wanted to make this transition?
You know, December 3rd made, or would have made, 29 years. And I retired a week before my 29th anniversary. And I think that for so many of us, the pandemic had us all reflecting. You know, is this what we want to do for the rest of our lives? Are we happy? Are there other things we want to do? And so I had been thinking about some of those things before the last year when I took some time off, and it was just, you know, I think it's time to just make that jump while and do some other things while I still can.
Your Chicago Chronicles column, what kind of stories did you try and highlight, try and tell with that column?
Sure. You know, the moniker was long-form columns about people and places that make Chicago tick, with the focus on black and brown communities. And for me, it was all about race, you know, all the many aspects of race, race, racism, discrimination, equity, inequity, you know, and then social justice, just all of those issues that plague our country. From poverty to crime to policing to politics and, you know, representation for black and brown communities, and those positive stories that just don't get told, those diverse narratives, the everyday heroes in neighborhoods all across the city, like WTTW tries to highlight now, you know, and just making sure that those stories are told.
You took a few years off to work for DCFS, a little bit in politics. You're credited with helping Representative Bobby Rush get reelected in 2000 during a very crowded race. He is also retiring this year, so you'll probably see him out there. but why did you, at the time, why did you move into communications and public relations, and why did you come back to journalism?
Sure. You know, I had been covering urban affairs and then kind of segued into covering DCFS for a while. And this was during the time in the or late 90s when DCFS was always in the news. So many tragic stories of children being killed. And at one point I got an outreach from DCFS, and they said, you know, hey, how'd you like to come to our side? It was kind of like, you know, we'd rather have you on this side than covering, you know. And at first I said no, but I think everyone has a point where they're like, well, maybe I could try something different. And so I decided to go try it. And, of course, children have always been my passion. And the majority of the children that were in the system are black and brown children. And so issues plaguing my community, the lack of adoption of those children in the system had always been an issue I was passionate about. So I went over there to see if I could make a difference, and did that for 2 years. And I will just say that politics makes strange bedfellows, and it's not easy. And so, you know, when I decided to, when Governor Edgar did not run again, I left and hung my own shingles and decided to continue doing public relations. And that's when I stayed in politics and worked with, did media and media strategy for members of the U.S. Congress, Chicago City Council, the Illinois Legislature. And it was during that time that I was the press secretary for Bobby Rush's campaign, when a little-known politician by the name of Barack Obama was vying for his seat. Yeah. And it would be the only race that Mr. Obama would lose on his upward trajectory to the White House. So it's it was bittersweet, and to see him, you know, go on and win those higher offices. And Bobby called me upon my retirement last week and said, hey, I see we're both retiring. We'll have to get together and have coffee
and talk about
reminisce.
Retiring.
Yes.
Now that you've got time, or
yes.
So they say.
Yes.
What would you say, you know, because you've covered obviously everything, and, you know, you've said that there are a number of stories that have impacted you. The story of Sandra Bland, Jesse Jackson, when he got his vaccine from one of the black doctors who helped to develop it,
yes.
Wilton Gregory, the home of Emmett Till.
Yes.
You know, what are some of the highlights that come to you that you think about right now, and why are those the highlights?
Hmm. I think in my early career, it was covering public housing and the transformation of public housing as the nation began to demolish them across the country. It began here in Chicago because of the violence and crime and gangs that plagued Chicago. And there were so many stories there. One of the ones that really moved me was the story of Dantrell Davis, the young boy who was shot on his way to school holding his mother's hand. You know, and this was gang shooting and other gang members. And so for me, those were the essence of those stories that were the essence of why public housing didn't work when you stack poor people on top of each other. And one of the stories I really enjoyed during that period was an exclusive interview with President Bill Clinton by merging in with residents of the public housing during a visit by the president. And because I am a black and brown person, I was able to be there and no one questioned me. And when he came out, I was able to get a few questions in before Secret Service recognized that
this is a journalist, not a resident.
Exactly.
Almost out of time, Maudlin. You know, you've written that your first book took about 17 years. The next book cannot take that long. What's next for you in about 20 seconds?
Sure. What's next is all manner of things. You know, I want to do some diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting. I want to do some work in protecting and promoting journalism, and I definitely will be entering academia at some point, you know, and most importantly, I will be starting that second book that cannot take 17 years.
Can't wait to read it. We're not done hearing from Maudlin Ahasrika yet. Thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you for having me.
And we're back with more Chicago Tonight in just a moment, but first, a look at the weather.
A spot on 26th Street wants to offer young Chicagoans a freshly fried twist on Mexican tradition. Producer Erica Gunderson recently brought us this story. Here's another look at El Churro Shop.
Churro is what we call a parachuto, which is very classical, which is just butter, flour, sugar, water. It's made multiple times a day, and we never refrigerate it, and we never freeze it, and we never hold it overnight.
It's not hard, it's just looking at the batter and the batter tells you when to stop.
Born in Spain, perfected in Mexico, churros, the crispy fried sugar-kissed dough sticks, are a familiar indulgence to many.
Crunchy outside, soft center, golden brown and delicious.
But even on 26th Street, churros fresh from the fryer are a rarity. Here at El Churro Shop, owner and Little Village native Aldo Rios is taking the sweet snack back to its Mexican roots.
A lot of people grew up with the idea of what a churro should be is stuffed. Traditionally, it was made by hand, it was made fresh, it was fried dough, and it wasn't really stuffed.
Rather than filling his churros, Rios offers house-made sauces and toppings to add adventure to his traditional treats.
We have our own chocolate with Choco Krispies, or we have a strawberry sauce, which is on the sweet side, with a coconut. We have a salted caramel, and then a really neat one is like a dulce de leche with mazapan.
Before opening El Churro Shop in July, Rios had worked in kitchens for his entire professional life. When the pandemic shutdowns caused his hours to be cut in 2020, Rios suddenly had one crucial ingredient that he had always been short on before, time.
It gave me enough time to think of something that I could do on my own. And for some reason, churros came up.
Rios developed a recipe and set up a deep fryer on the sidewalk at 26th and St. Louis, where he discovered the old way of making churros was new to many Little Village residents.
People started coming up. They really didn't know what I was doing. They thought I was frying fish for some reason. Once they saw that I was actually making churros, seeing it being made by hand with a piping and scissors and cutting it and fried to order, I was like, wow, is that really how you make a churro? I'm like, yeah, that's exactly how it is.
Not long after, Rios also began making churros in pop-ups and at private events. But even though people loved his product, he says opening a brick-and-mortar shop didn't occur to him until...
Me and my wife, one day, were just driving up and down 26th Street, wanted a place to sit down, have coffee, just have a conversation and just hang out, to be honest. And we didn't find that. We didn't have a really space that we could actually do that.
it wasn't really like the intention, but we saw the lack of in the neighborhood and we pursued it.
Now, Rios hopes he's found the secret sauce for success by creating a place for community in Little Village.
Everybody is welcome to come in, sit down, have a conversation. If you have no internet at home, you're welcome to use it here, have your computer, work on an assignment, do research, whatever it is, and enjoy a hot beverage, enjoy a churro, enjoy something that like, we're trying to present culturally, traditionally. We have a young crowd here, and let's keep them here, let's keep them in the neighborhood. And there's plenty of potential to do a lot of stuff and keep it within the neighborhood and keep it ours.
For Chicago Tonight, this is Erica Gunderson.
Churros aren't the only... Delicious. They are. They're all delicious. They're not the only dough getting the hot oil treatment at El Churro Shop. They also fry up an American classic, funnel cakes. You'll find more about El Churro Shop. It's churro. I should have just said it that way, the proper way. You'll find more about El Churro on our website. We're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
If only we had some churros to help us close
maybe,
out the show.
Maybe we'll head over there after the
maybe
show.
Maybe we will. That's our show for this Thursday night. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schatz. Thank you all so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe. We'll see you tomorrow.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm pleased to give back to the community through numerous charitable initiatives.